This is The Critique. Today, we're looking at a submission analyzing two draft appellate judgments that really try to define the boundaries of applying English matrimonial law in Anglophone Cameroon.
It's all about how a legal system is supposed to navigate a frozen historical date while still trying to function in the modern world.
Exactly. So let's get straight into the first critique point, which is really about the core legal argument.
Let's do it.
So a key theme running through this material seems to be this tension between history and practicality. The manuscript's most critical task is reconciling the tension between the freeze of English law in 1961 and the continued use of the Matrimonial Causes Act, the MCA, from 1973.
Right.
And currently, the logic connecting those two concepts, it feels a bit, well, circular rather than linear.
That is the central paradox here, isn't it? The source material asserts, and it's quite right based on the 1961 Constitution, that the dynamic reception of English law just stopped dead. October 1, 1961.
The door was shut.
The door was shut. We can't just import new English laws because they're newer or supposedly better, but then, almost in the same breath, the text pivots to accepting the MCA 1973, a statute enacted 12 years after that door was shut.
Right. And it relies very heavily on stare decisis and this concept of consolidation to bridge that gap. It points to cases, you know, Embru or Stephen B. Fomunkong Atanga, and essentially says,
we use the 1973 Act because we've used it before.
Exactly.
That's clearly laid out. I wonder, though, what's the risk with that argument? I mean, if the only reason you're using a post-free statute is because we said so previously, any skeptical constitutional lawyer could just, you know, tear that apart.
Mm.
The weakness here is that the mechanism of how a frozen system absorbs a future statute, it's not really articulated. It relies too heavily on precedent rather than explaining why it's constitutionally permissible in the first place.
It mentions the distinction between consolidating acts and innovating acts.
It mentions it, yeah, but it's not rigorously applied as a litmus test.
I see what you're getting at here. So let's see how we can strengthen this. We need to refine the argument to explicitly categorize English statutes based on their content relative to that 1961 freeze, not just their date.
Precisely. And building on that, what if we looked at it through, say, a container analogy? The draft needs a section that explicitly argues that the MCA 1973 is acceptable only because it's a container for principles that existed before October 1, 1961.
Ah, so it's not new law.
It's not new law, it's old law in a new wrapper. The judgment should basically state, we don't apply the 1973 Act because it's English law. We apply the principles inside it because they predate 1961, and the 73 Act is just the most convenient vehicle for reading them.
That makes the rejection of later laws much stronger too, doesn't it? If the 73 Act is just a wrapper for pre-1961 law, then anything that changes the substance is just out.
Absolutely. Is there a risk that focusing only on the date might miss the nuance? Yes. By using the container analogy, you can immediately contrast this with, say, the Matrimonial and Family Proceedings Act 1984.
Okay.
You explain that the 84 Act is rejected not just because of the date, but because it introduces structural innovations like transfers to county courts or reducing time bars to 1 year that simply didn't exist in that 1961 frozen snapshot. Those aren't consolidations, they're new inventions.
I love that. It visualizes the Constitution as a kind of filter.
Yes. Suggest drafting a section that treats the 1961 Constitution as a filter. Only English laws that can pass through it, either by being compatible with local structures or just being consolidations, survive. This makes rejecting the 2020 no-fault divorce law feel inevitable, you know? Logical, not arbitrary.
It creates a robust intellectual barrier.
It does. It stresses that dynamic adaptation stopped in 61. We aren't copying England's evolution. We are preserving our specific reception of it.
Moving on. Let's look closely at the section discussing the historical context in the Polo case. The draft dedicates a lot of space to the history of English legal reform, specifically the Beeching Commission and court congestion in the 60s, which I think risks diluting the focus on the actual Cameroonian reality.
It is a very thorough history lesson. But is the connection between the Beeching Commission and the Fako High Court fully established? Or is that an area to potentially, you know, bolster?
Well, the weakness I see here is that the section detailing the Matrimonial Causes Rules of 1977 goes really deep into the special procedure for undefended divorces in English county courts.
Right.
It mentions stats like 80% of petitions were undefended and discusses the backlog in the English High Court. It's interesting, but this deep dive, it distracts from the immediate issue. The Fako High Court is not a county court.
So the reader gets lost?
A Cameroonian lawyer reading this might get lost in the weeds of English administrative history and completely miss the so what for their own court's competence.
It's fascinating history, but you're right. What are the limitations of including it? It risks diluting the main point. So the suggestion here is to pivot the historical context from narrative to contrast. Use the English history only to highlight why it doesn't apply to Cameroon.
Okay, so what I really like about that approach is it turns a history lesson into a weaponized legal argument. How do we do that specifically?
First, you trim the fat. Remove the specific stats about English High Court backlogs in the 60s. They don't help the Cameroonian judge decide the case in front of them.
Right.
Instead, focus on structure. Don't just explain why England created county courts. Focus on why Cameroon's 2011 Judicial Organization Law creates a unified jurisdiction in the High Court.
So you frame it as an incompatibility argument?
Exactly. Frame it as, look, because the 1977 rules were designed to empower English county courts, which are institutions that just do not exist in our hierarchy, those specific sections are structurally incompatible with our high court system.
That clears things up a lot.
It explicitly answers the appellant's confusion. The appellant in the text seems to think the 77 rules limit the high court because they limited the English high court. You have to use the history to prove that limitation was administrative for England, not a legal principle for Cameroon.
That makes sense. It stops the reader from wondering why they're reading about English bureaucracy and brings them right back to Cameroonian law. Okay, let's shift to the procedural heart of the first judgment. This involves the rectification remedy.
Mm-hmm. The distinction between a procedural defect, which is curable, and a jurisdictional lack, which is fatal, is the practical heart of these rulings. But the consequences of noncompliance, they need to be framed with a lot more urgency.
I agree. The ruling correctly identifies that missing a marriage certificate or the Form 4 children statement, that's a procedural slip, not a lack of jurisdiction. The court still has the power to hear the case.
But, the text frames the remedy a bit passively. It lists options, rejection, adjournment, striking out, as if they're all just equal choices on a menu for the judge.
Right. It says the judge may postpone or may order rectification. It feels a little soft considering what's at stake.
Is there a risk that this softness undermines the welfare of the child principle? I think so. The suggestion is to tighten that consequence of noncompliance section, make it a hard edge for practitioners. Move from the judge has options to the judge has a duty.
So we want to see more actionable language here.
Yes. For concrete examples, let's introduce the concept of conditional jurisdiction. You reframe the argument to say, the court has jurisdiction over the marriage, but its jurisdiction to grant relief is suspended until the procedural defect is cured.
Oh, that's a sharper legal distinction.
It is. It's much sharper than just saying, don't strike it out yet. It tells the lawyer, you're in the room, but you can't speak until you fix this.
It's for the children.
That needs to be the moral center of the judgment. When discussing Rule 43, explicitly link the procedural failure to the paramount interest of the child. Instead of saying the court may postpone, change the guidance to something like the court must stay proceedings. A petition without a Form 4 is a petition that ignores the child's welfare, and the court cannot hear it.
That raises the stakes from just a paperwork error to a moral and legal failure.
It does. It forces the practitioner to realize that the content of the form matters more than just the filing of the form.
That gives the judgment real teeth. It stops being about rules and starts being about justice. Okay, for our final major critique point, this goes back to the legal authorities being cited. The reliance on Mumburu Stephen and Bifumunkun Atanga is pivotal, but the text currently presents these precedents as isolated data points rather than a cohesive body of adopted law.
That makes sense. But could the evidence also support a different conclusion, maybe a broader doctrine of adoption?
Well, the document cites these cases to prove that the MCA 1973 and MCR 1977 are applicable. It essentially says, look, the Northwest Court of Appeal did it in 2012, and the Southwest Court of Appeal did it in 2017.
And the argument stops there.
As I understand it from the notes, yes. It doesn't explicitly explain how those specific cases successfully navigated the 1961 freeze argument. It just says they applied it.
Right. And that leaves a gap. A skeptical lawyer could just argue those previous cases were wrongly decided if the freeze logic isn't clearly explained within those precedents.
So the suggestion here is to synthesize the precedents into a doctrine of adoption, show that these cases didn't just use the 1973 Act, they established a customary usage of it.
This ties back to Section 32 of the 2006 Judicial Organization Law, right? The part about usages hitherto applicable?
Exactly.
You have to leverage Section 32. The argument should be, because appellate courts have consistently used the 1973 and 77 rules since the 80s, these rules have transitioned from being English statutes to being Cameroonian judicial usage.
I see. So stare decisis isn't just following the leader.
No, you frame stare decisis as the mechanism that converts frozen English law into living Cameroonian practice. This solidifies the authority of the High Court to reject the 1984 or 2020 Act. Why? Because there's no usage to support them.
We haven't been using the 2020 Act for 30 years.
Exactly. So it hasn't become custom. The 1973 Act has. That's the bridge that solves the circular logic we started with.
That connects everything beautifully. It answers why the 1973 Act is in and the 2020 Act is out, without relying solely on that container theory. It adds a layer of customary practice, which is very strong in this jurisdiction.
It creates a sort of a belt and braces approach. You have the container consolidation argument for the statute itself, proving it fits the 1961 freeze, and the usage stare decisis argument for its application, proving it's been adopted by custom. It makes the judgment bulletproof.
Bulletproof against anyone trying to argue that dynamic adaptation is still happening.
Exactly. It confirms dynamic adaptation is dead, but customary adoption is alive.
All right, let's recap what we've covered today. This submission is incredibly rich, dealing with some very high-level constitutional interpretation, but it needs some structural tightening to be truly definitive.
Right. So to summarize our actionable suggestions, first, clarify that container versus innovation distinction. Justify using the 1973 laws by showing their old law in a new wrapper, while the 84 Act is new innovation.
Okay.
Second, prune that English administrative history. Use the county court narrative only to prove structural incompatibility, not as general background.
Third, harden the language on procedural rectification.
Yeah, make that Form 4 for the children a non-negotiable barrier. Frame it as conditional jurisdiction. And finally, synthesize those precedents. Use Section 32 and stare decisis to frame the 1973 Act as Cameroonian judicial usage, distinguishing it from the alien 2020 Act.
The material makes a really strong case for the High Court's jurisdiction, but with these edits, it won't just be a judgment. It'll be a definitive textbook guide for the Anglophone bar. It's a masterful navigation of complex constitutional history that just needs that final layer of logical cement.
It really is impressive work. It just needs to close those tiny logical loops to stop any creative lawyers from trying to smuggle in the 2020 no-fault divorce laws down the line.
We would love to see this revised judgment once those arguments are sharpened. Please submit it back for a final polishing review. Thanks for listening to The Critique.